By anybody's imagination, these numbers are staggering.
State lawmakers work out the final details on a plan to share Alaska's oil wealth. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 5th of August. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, a warm reception for President Bush on Eielson Air Force Base in Fairbanks.
I think the crowd was just really very excited, and he just got us all enthusiastic and proud to be Americans.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local Fish and Game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game.
State Senate leaders this afternoon explained the principles behind the energy relief bill they passed last night. Senate Finance Co-Chairman Bert Stedman and Lyman Hoffman, testifying before the House Finance Committee, said their goal was to assist as many people as possible. Hoffman said when the price of oil is high, Alaskans hurt. And he pointed to the advantages of the two-year plan.
That gets us away from trying to work out an energy package for another year next year. This will give us breathing room so we can address the high costs of energy and a longer-term solution for all Alaskans.
The governor's original plan would have given every Alaskan a one-time check for $1,200, but the Senate plan would increase this year's permanent fund dividend by $500. Stedman said the goal of the overall plan was to provide warm homes no matter what fuel is used. The state would reimburse the cost of home heating oil when it goes above $3 a gallon. It would also increase the support for those who rely on the Power Cost Equalization Program by basing it on the real cost of generating electricity with diesel power generators. And it provides a comparable break for people who heat their homes with natural gas and for those in urban communities who heat their homes with electricity but don't now qualify for the Power Cost Equalization Program.
What we didn't want to do is give away free fuel. We didn't want the price so low that people weren't conserving. But we didn't want it so high where there's challenges in heating the residents' home.
Hoffman said Alaska is awash in money. He told the House committee that if the oil prices average $110 a barrel this year, the state will end the year with savings of $12 billion.
By anybody's imagination, these numbers are staggering.
Senate bill is scheduled to appear on the House floor this evening. The special session must end by Thursday night. The continual rise in home heating fuel is causing concern for some Kodiak residents for this coming winter, especially for low and fixed-income families. KMXD's Mary Donaldson has more.
In August of 2007, the average price of heating fuel from North Pacific Fuel in Kodiak was about $2.97 per gallon. Today, the average price per gallon ranges from $4.82 to $5.13 per gallon, according to a spokesperson for the company. That's an increase of $2.16 for some, which is an increase of almost 100% compared to the same time a year ago. Pat Branson, the director of the Kodiak Senior Center, says she sees firsthand the trouble rising fuel costs are creating.
There's no doubt, and I can tell you from paying bills at the Senior Center and also being on the Alaska Commission on Aging and having just read this survey from different senior service providers throughout the state, those utility costs are escalated at about 33% increase. So it's difficult on a personal level, on an agency level, and certainly statewide.
She says she regularly receives calls from fixed income residents looking for help with their rising electric and fuel bills. However, there is assistance available in town for residents seeking extra help with their bills.
Well, Brother Francis has been operating a homeless prevention program for 15 years. And yes, over the last 3 years, we've had a 66% increase in homeless prevention activities. In other words, with people coming in to seek assistance for either rental assistance so they don't get evicted or for utility assistance, such as an empty oil tank or an electric bill that's overdue.
That was Monty Hover of the Kodiak Brother Francis Shelter. He says the program is financed through grants and federal assistance.
Basically, it's there as a safety net for families that have either fell on hard times or perhaps got an injury or a sickness and are in danger of becoming either evicted or they simply don't have the money to pay for the high cost of oil and electric these days.
Marcella Dillon is a fixed income resident and says she cuts back on her travel so she can afford her fuel bill.
I don't make any unnecessary trips to the store or town anymore. And I just don't travel anymore. A lot of it is because of the prices rising. The main thing, of course, is heating oil here. I imagine that this winter is going to take most of my Social Security check to pay my oil bill.
She says her fuel bill has more than doubled since last summer. In July 2007, she paid $232 to have her tank filled, compared to the $507 she paid last month. Haver says the energy rebate being decided upon right now by the state legislature would be very beneficial to Alaska residents for this upcoming winter. The bill will help with the escalating electricity and fuel costs if passed, and as Haver notes, is needed at this time.
It shouldn't be underestimated how hard the impact is on families with these high oil prices and high electrical prices. It's having a tremendous negative impact on families and people on fixed incomes. A lot of people are going to have a tough winter making it through with these high heating bills.
I'm Mary Donaldson.
President Bush met with Fairbanks area military personnel yesterday during a brief stopover at Eielson Air Force Base. KUAC's Dan Bross has the story.
Eielson rolled out the red carpet for the country's commander-in-chief during Monday's rare Alaska presidential visit.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Air Force One landed at Eielson to refuel as the President, First Lady Laura Bush, and their daughter Barbara began a trip to Asia. A receptive audience of about 1,000 military personnel, their families, and a few officials, including Senator Ted Stevens and Governor Palin, were assembled inside a massive aircraft hangar to hear the president. Bush's message was a familiar one of gratitude to troops and maintaining the course in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I can't thank you enough for all the sacrifices you have given. There is no question we have the finest military in the world, and one reason why is because we've got the finest military families in the world. These have been tough times on our families, and I want to thank you for staying in the fight. You understand what I know, that it is best to defeat the enemy overseas so we do not have to face them here in the United States.
President Bush reassured troops that the length of overseas assignments will not stray from the year-long deployments announced earlier this summer. Bush emphasized the importance of keeping terrorists on the run and being proactive, saying the U.S. is laying the foundation for future peace. The president specifically thanked individual Army, Air Force, and National Guard units on hand yesterday. He also singled out one decorated soldier for recognition.
I've seen firsthand the character of the men and women who wear our uniform. I know such a man named Sergeant Gregory Williams. He's right here with us today. He was on night patrol in Baghdad when his vehicle was hit by an explosive device. His heroism that night saved the lives of his fellow soldiers. And for that, he received the Distinguished Service Cross.
Bush broadened the gratitude and again thanked all service people before concluding his speech and heading into the crowd to shake hands. After the address, Sergeant Gregory Williams said he was proud to be singled out by the president.
It's a great honor. It's not very often that a soldier gets recognized in front of all his fellow soldiers like that, and it was probably one of the most exciting moments of my life.
Sergeant Williams said the president's stop at Eielson was a great morale booster for him and the rest of the Stryker Brigade, which is preparing to deploy to Iraq this fall. Eielson grammar school teacher and Air Force veteran Carol Kaloji said she was impressed with the president.
Just really sincere, and he was able to stay and meet with us, and I got to shake his hand and talk with him, and also with Laura Bush as well, and I think the crowd was just really very excited, and he just got us all enthusiastic and proud to be Americans.
Kaloji said she knows President Bush has come under a lot of criticism, but that he has kept the country safe and she supports him. As part of yesterday's visit to Eielson, the president presented a volunteer service award to local AmeriCorps volunteer Carolyn Wolfe. with the Fairbanks branch of the Literacy Council of Alaska. Bush's visit was his first to Alaska since meeting with troops in Anchorage in 2005. His stop at Eielson yesterday was the first by a U.S. president to interior Alaska since Ronald Reagan met with the Pope in Fairbanks in 1984. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a hot commodity goes missing at the Bethel Docks.
That's been kind of the mystery, is that they're not really over there stealing everything in the boat. They're just after the gas.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Two dozen Republicans in the U.S. House are continuing their protest in Washington, D.C., refusing to go home for the August recess. Even though Congress started its five-week break last Friday, about 25 Republicans returned to the Capitol yesterday and today to demand action on offshore oil drilling and increasing domestic oil supply by opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. They're calling their plan the American Energy Act, and they say they want the House Speaker, Democrat Nancy Pelosi, to call the House back into session to vote on offshore drilling. California Republican Duncan Hunter says it would show Americans that Congress is doing something about high energy costs.
It's very important that the Speaker come back, bring this House back into session, and do the responsible thing, which is to increase the dependence or the independence of the United States with respect to petroleum. That means we have to drill. We've got to drill in Alaska. We've got to drill in the deep water off of our coast.
But House Speaker Pelosi has said that the Republican plan supports the oil industry, including ExxonMobil, which is bringing in record profits. Last week in Washington, Michigan Democrat Bart Stupak fought back against Republican colleagues who are pushing to drill in the Arctic Refuge.
You want to go to ANWR? You keep bringing up ANWR. What about the Natural Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, which has proven reserves, has been around since 1923, Warren G. Hardy, and you still can't find your way there to drill? Instead, you want to go in a wildlife preserve and drill.
It's up to President Bush to call Congress back into session, and he has not. But Republicans say they plan to make speeches all week on the House floor, even though the microphones and cameras are off. Congressman Don Young is not part of the protest. He came back to Alaska last week and is now traveling the state campaigning for this month's Republican primary battle. Meanwhile, Senator Ted Stevens sent a letter to President George Bush on Friday requesting an executive order to do a seismic survey of the Arctic Refuge. Stevens' letter says it would show the hydrocarbon resources in the region, updating information that's 25 years old. 9 other Republican senators signed on to the letter, including Alaska's Lisa Murkowski. Exploration leading to development cannot be done without congressional approval, but Stevens says the seismic research should be outside of those rules. The Bethel Boat Harbor is a crowded place this time of year as hundreds of travelers head to and from the villages, but the harbor has become an easy target for theft. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Parking is limited at Bethel's small boat harbor. There are usually 300 to 400 trucks, cars, and boat trailers parked on land, and up to 300 boats packed into the small lake that makes up the harbor. The Bethel Port Department oversees all of this activity, selling around 800 to 900 permits a year to boat owners to use the harbor. And every year, the city's department sees some theft at the launch site, occasionally. But it's nothing like what they're seeing there today.
With the price of gas being what it is, gas is quite a bit of money, so some of this is getting maybe to be a little bit on the serious side.
Pete Williams is the harbor master and the acting port director. He's been in Bethel for 25 years and is seeing the amount of theft increase this year. He says the perpetrators are after one main commodity, gasoline.
And if there's a fishing rod or something like that, they might snatch that. That's been kind of the mystery, is that they're not really over there stealing everything in the boat. They're just after the gas.
Bethel's gasoline is at $6 a gallon, and it's much higher in the surrounding villages. Boats are easy targets because gas is often in small containers that can be quickly grabbed and carried away. The city has port attendance workers at the boat harbor most hours of the day and night. There are also surveillance cameras. The port is pursuing upgrades to their surveillance system because Williams says the cameras are outdated.
All we can really do at the moment is if we happen to know the guy's walk or cut of his coat or shape of his car, and we'll go after him on that premise, but it's just a little bit out of date, and we can't, the resolution is such that it isn't good enough to use in court.
The Bethel Port Department is telling residents to keep an eye out for each other's property and suggests residents get locking caps for their gas tanks. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is asking the public's help in putting together a plan to determine if a cleanup of the former Susitna gunnery range will be necessary. APRN's Ellen Lockyer has more.
During the Cold War, gunners at Anchorage's Elmendorf Air Force Base fired at moving targets towed by planes over Knickarm. Most of the shells fired exploded in the air, but there are concerns now that maybe some of them didn't. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' Carrie Kaseboom is heading up a new project called the Susitna Gunnery Range Interviews, which is aimed at finding out more about unexploded ordnance at Point McKenzie.
For the 6 years between 52 and 58, they used to shoot anti-aircraft rounds at targets that were pulled by an airplane across the Point McKenzie area. So it's possible that some of these rounds landed without exploding and therefore represent a potential hazard to people who are disturbing the ground in Point McKenzie area.
The concerns are not new, but Kaseboom says old reports regarding the military use of the area yield scant information.
Just looking into the old reports of the area, what we could glean from archive records, so we know just a little bit, and that's how we know that there were approximately four reports of ordnance fragments in the area dating back to 1970.
The Point McKenzie area used to be low priority for a cleanup program, but plans for increased development at Point Mac are prompting new action. Kaseboom says there is some indication that some shells could still be underground or sunk in wetlands.
The round of use was a 90 millimeter high explosive, and it was fired from Elmendorf Air Force Base.
The Air Force Base gunnery range covered the Point McKenzie Road area between Elmendorf and the Little Susitna River south and west of Burma Road. The Susitna Gunnery Range program is at present seeking information from the public.
We're also sending out questionnaires to all the known landowners in the area for them to fill out, and just so we can get a better feel for how we can keep them informed and what do they know. Like maybe there's a lot more ordnance out there than we previously knew about.
Kaseboom says it's too soon to determine if an investigation and cleanup will be necessary. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska, and by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888, the number 4, and then Alaska.
Biologists with a nonprofit research group had a rare treat yesterday, the chance to study a super pod of killer whales in Ketchumak Bay. The North Gulf Oceanic Society is doing whale research this year in Lower Cook Inlet. After a local tour boat called in a killer whale sighting, the biologists found more than they had bargained for. KBBI's Emily Schwing reports.
The North Gulf Oceanic Society research vessel Natoa had received reports of killer whales in Ketchumak Bay, and at about 12:30 in the afternoon, we spotted the first group of close to 100 killer whales.
This is a whale extravaganza. God, you have to make your head spin.
NGOS Director Craig Matkin has been photographing killer whales in Alaska since 1977. As we approach the whales on the east side of Kachemak Bay, we see rows of dorsal fins emerging from the water. Researchers call this picket fencing, and that's exactly what it looks like. The whales are slapping their flukes and swimming shoulder to shoulder. They're nearly on top of each other, and although it might not seem like it, Matkin says the whales are resting.
When they're lined up like this, it's perfect for identification of individuals. Makes it a lot easier when you look at the pictures later on.
Okay. At least four different pods of killer whales are congregating in Kachemak Bay. Matkin says when the whales come together like this, it's quite the social event.
Yeah, they're really social animals, and when they rest, it's when they get all their socializing out, I guess. It's really
tactile.
Important. Yeah, it's really important for them to touch in with their close relatives pretty frequently.
And they're probably listening to this other group approaching from Pogie.
Yeah, they
from
may be doing
Pogie
that.
Point. They can hear that kind of distance, and they may be excited if it's a new group they haven't seen in a while. And when they get together with another group that they haven't seen in a while, they can put on quite a display and a lot of socializing going on and kind of re-meeting friends.
That's Cy St. Amand. He's also a researcher with NGOS. He says not only is this particular encounter rare, but so is the project he's working on.
One thing that's unusual for this encounter is that NOAA has provided funding this year for research into the possible predation of transient killer whales on beluga whales. And so the funding we're using today is to map out the different killer whales that are using Cook Inlet in relation to their potential for interaction with beluga whales. That's unique to have funding this year for Cook Inlet. It's the first time we've had that, and it's a real benefit to our larger program over the whole state here.
There are three different kinds of killer whales, but only two of them live in Alaska. Resident killer whales eat only fish, and the transient killer whales eat other marine mammals. Matkin and his colleague L.A. Holmes say it's easy to tell which whales are residents and which aren't, just by looking at their dorsal fins.
The shape of the fin and the saddle patch, you notice how some of the saddle patches have a dark indentation in them that we call a open saddle. And that's only in residents. Saddle patch is smaller generally in residents. The fins aren't as pointy.
After Matkin and St. Amand are finished photographing the animals, Matkin uses a small charge and a buoyant dart to retrieve a skin and blubber sample from two free-swimming adult males.
Good speed, left. One more left. Good speed. He's right square with you, Craig. He's square. He's coming up.
Oh, shoot. Stuck.
That's funny. I'm going to watch.
The biopsy samples are about 3 centimeters long and only a few millimeters in diameter. Once he returns to land, Matkin will analyze the skin samples for DNA and stable isotope information. He'll also sample the blubber for contaminants and information about what the whale has been eating. And right now, it's likely silver salmon, which, like its predator, won't stay for long in Kachemak Bay. Reporting from the Natoa, I'm Emily Schwing.
A new hydropower project set to go online in 2009 could wean Juneau from expensive diesel fuel supplements and serve as a backup if the much larger Snettisham plant goes down again. KTOO's Weld Royal has the story.
Type in coordinates for Lake Dorothy into Google Earth, and mapping software takes you to a stunning high mountain lake 16 miles southeast of Juneau on the east shore of Taku Inlet. Alaska Electric Light and Power is building the two-phase Lake Dorothy project. The first part is scheduled to be finished next fall at a cost of about $64 million. It uses a mix of engineering brawn and Mother Nature. It actually begins in an 800-foot-long tunnel that's next to a powerful waterfall flowing from Lake Dorothy. Ben Roberts is a superintendent for the Redpath Group. It's building the tunnel.
And at the lake, we'll blast a hole into the lake bed. The back of the drift will fill up with water to this point, and then from here it will go into the pipe, come to the valve, and it'll be piped from here on out.
The pipe will carry Lake Dorothy water to the adjacent waterfall that drains into Lake Louis at a lower elevation. Water will spill out of Louis into Bart Lake, where a long pipe will carry it to a powerhouse. There, it will be converted to electricity and sent along a 3.5-mile transmission line that connects to the Snettisham distribution system. The water flow from Lake Dorothy will be managed by a giant faucet remotely controlled from AELMP's offices in Juneau. Already, the project has been delayed by unforeseen problems. Earlier this year, AEL&P agreed to pay a federal fine of $125,000 after its contractors accidentally destroyed an eagle's nest near the site of the powerhouse. Last year, nesting eagles in the same area forced contractors to stop work temporarily, according to utility contractor Ed Johnson.
There are two other eagle nests a short distance from where we're at. There's one only about 300 feet in from that tree line. When we were doing our work here last year, a pair of eagles nested there. That made it impossible for us to finish this work last spring.
Johnson says steep terrain also has made the project difficult. Lake Dorothy's construction challenges are part of the reason the project was chosen for a national television series called Tougher in Alaska. The Lake Dorothy segment will be featured in early August on the History Channel. This phase of the Lake Dorothy project will generate about 20% of Juneau's current hydropower capacity, according to Willis. It will never replace the much larger Snettisham, but if that plant were to go down again, having Lake Dorothy online would mean Juneau has to rely less on diesel than in the recent energy emergency. But Lake Dorothy may not satisfy Juneau's demand for inexpensive hydropower as long as originally thought. A utility's equivalent of predicting the future is called load forecasting. It's up to Willis to look 20 years in the future and figure out how much electricity Juneau will need. He believes if the price of heating oil continues to go up, residents will switch to less expensive electricity to heat their homes, and that will cause overall power usage to grow quickly.
I had not counted on the huge run-up in the cost of oil, which I think now is going to drive a lot more people to shift very quickly from oil heat to electric heat. And so when I do my load forecast next year, it may show a huge increase in demand.
Currently, the second phase of the Lake Dorothy project, designed to serve the Juneau market, is expected to begin construction in 2020. But if demand warrants, it could happen sooner. At Lake Dorothy, I'm Weld Royal.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Mary Donaldson in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Emily Schwing in Homer, and Weld Royal in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Alan Lockyer from Point McKenzie. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and David Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster, and I'm Duncan Moon. Have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska. The new AT&T, your world, delivered. And by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local fish and game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.